This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. While Martin Luther King Jr.'s actual birthday was last Friday, today is the federal holiday honoring the late civil rights leader.
Dr. King is remembered as a pioneer in his nonviolent approach to seeking equal rights for African Americans. He's best known for his leadership role in the Montgomery bus boycott, the creation of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and the iconic March on Washington, during which he gave the speech often referred to simply as his I Have a Dream speech.
But King gave thousands of speeches, including one very late in his life that Celia Jackson believes is worth a much closer look. Jackson is the executive director for the International and Intercultural Center at Alverno College. She spoke over the weekend at the 25th annual Martin Luther King prayer service in Milwaukee. She also joined us by phone. Welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure.
So for people who aren't familiar with Dr. King's speech, his sermon, really, on remaining awake through the Great Revolution, can you share a little background on it? This was a speech he delivered just a few days before he was killed.
That's correct. It was delivered in Washington, D.C. on March 31st. And it's a very powerful speech. I think probably a lot of people may not be aware of this particular speech, and the fact of the matter is, Dr. King has so many sermons, so many speeches, so many writings. I mean, there's such a rich volume of information and insight that he shared during his short lifetime. And then this particular one, he talks about some of our challenges and talks about a triple revolution that we're facing, and gave some insights on some different things that we can do in recognizing this triple revolution. And it breaks down into three particular areas, one being technology. And I always find that so interesting when I was listening to the speech and doing a little research on it, just to talk about technology in 1968 and looking at how far we've come in 2016.
Right.
It's just really unbelievable. And, you know, he talks about our neighborhood changing from being our neighbor next door to a global neighborhood, which in fact we do have with the World Wide Web and
right.
the Internet. So it was just so interesting to see that kind of insight coming from almost 50 years ago.
Right. It maybe strains credulity to imagine that he envisioned Facebook and Twitter, but this vision of a technological revolution really does have some resonance 47 years later, 48 years later.
That's correct. Absolutely. One of the other revolution he talks about is this whole notion around weaponry. And I think in this particular instance, he was talking a lot about what was happening with the Vietnam War. But we have just seen our communities really saturated with guns. We've seen an increase in gun violence. We see war on many different fronts all over the world. And so he was really giving some cautions about being engaged in warfare almost 50 years ago, and here we are involved in war on so many different fronts. So, again, very relevant information that he shared, you know, not being able to know what was going to happen in the future, but really kind of giving us some guidance that if we don't change our ways, things will only get worse.
Well, and so then the third part of this triple revolution he was talking about was the human rights revolution. And what was he referring to then, and how do you see that reflected in the human rights paradigm today?
Well, I mean, the whole notion around human rights, you know, was certainly consistent with what was happening with the civil rights movement and the fight against poverty, poor people, just so many injustices. I mean, one of his big avocations was the injustice on racial inequality. And so all of those human rights matters. And of course, you know, when we look at it today, we look not only at just racial injustices, we look at just how we treat one another based on people's faith traditions. We look at just the mass violence that's happening all over the world. We look at how people are treated in war-torn communities and the way that we extract information with prisoners of war. All of those are infringes on human rights. But I think that one of the things that he was very actively engaged in addition to speaking out against the war back in 1968, was this whole notion around poverty. And if you recall, he was involved heavily in the Poor People's Campaign, which is something that was really gaining momentum just before he was assassinated. And so just this whole idea of how do we really address poverty. And if we look back over the last almost 40, 50 years, and we can look at different parts of the world where people have been starving, you know, there have been refugees in many parts of the world, certainly in many African countries, certainly in some Eastern European parts of the world, in the Middle East. I mean, we just have so many human rights infractions that people are engaging in all over the world.
Well, it is a long speech, about 48 minutes, and I think it's about two-thirds of the way through that he says, and I'll quote here, "Ultimately, a great nation is a compassionate nation. America has not met its obligations and its responsibilities to the poor." Looking specifically at America now, as you look at the America he was talking about in 1968, and you look at Milwaukee and this country today, have things improved at all?
No, I don't think that they've improved. I mean, I think on some level you might see some semblance of improvement, and people like to kind of hold on to that. But in the greater and grander scheme of things, our numbers with respect to all the disparities have substantially increased. We could be talking about our healthcare system and, you know, just the high infant mortality rate. We could be talking about the criminal justice system. We could be talking about our educational system and some of the directions in which we have moved, which have actually increased the disparities. So I think that during that particular period of time, he was really kind of giving us something to work from in order to be able to address some of these concerns. But I really don't think that we've taken it on with the kind of will and compassion necessary in order to make a shift.
One of the other points he made in his speech was that he believed it was a myth that only time could solve the problem of racial injustice. Do you see that as a myth that persists, or do people necessarily view racial injustice today the way they did in 1968?
Well, I don't know if they view it in the same way as they did in 1968. Clearly, we don't have the same types of things like we have with the Jim Crow system that, you know, he was really actively engaged in trying to break down. But, you know, when we look at Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, we see that, you know, there's an argument that's being made that we've shifted from one form of economic injustice or caste system to a new type of caste system where we have a high incarceration rate of black males. And so I think that the lens is a little bit different because the circumstances we're looking at things are a little bit different, but at the end of the day, we still have a high level of inequality, and we have a high level of disparity for people of color in this country. And so the question is, how are we going to really be able to turn that around? And I think that it really is a matter of the heart. It's a matter of people's compassion and what are people willing to do. And it also requires people to give up some level of comfort in order to be able to make those things happen. And that's not always an easy thing for people to embrace or to agree upon. And one of the things he talks about, and many people have talked about this, is that there's this whole notion of shared power. And when you look at a lot of, whether you're looking in government, whether you're looking at corporations, whether you're looking at institutions of higher learning, whatever you're looking at, there's oftentimes an imbalance of who is actually sitting at the table making the decisions. And so really this notion of having shared power with people of different backgrounds, with different experiences, so that they can have an opportunity to help determine their future and their destiny, I think a lot of times is something that's missing. And so how do we get people to willingly agree to share some of that power so people can be able to have something to say about their destiny?
I know it's never really ideal to try to get inside the mind of a figure who has been gone for as long as Dr. King has, but it really would be fascinating to imagine how he would view this time in American history.
Yeah, I think that he would really be very saddened at the level of gun violence that is happening in our country. I mean, the guns on the streets and all of the incidents that we've been seeing on college campuses and in schools and in movie theaters and all kind of places where we're seeing mass shootings. I mean, these are things that, you know, we've almost become anesthetized to because they happen relatively frequently. But I just was so struck when I was listening to President Obama the other day talking about the whole gun control piece, and, you know, he talked about how angry he was with, you know, what was happening with the kids, and then he turned around and said, but it happens on the streets of Chicago every day. And so I think that those types of things he would really be very saddened by. I think he would also be saddened by what's happened with our educational system and how we have moved to this whole notion of privatization. And there's still great disparity, you know. So privatization was always suggested that it was going to help close the gap, and I don't believe that that's happened. Actually, it's kind of increased the gap in many different ways, because in a lot of our urban school settings, we have a really huge gap and we have a high dropout rate. So, I mean, I think when people who may have been very involved in those struggles to make sure that we had integration and people had good education, and to look to see that the disparities are as high, if not higher, in some places, it would really be, it would probably make them very sad. And that would be my best guess.
Well, was it an eye-opener for you to go back and revisit the speech?
It absolutely was. And I went ahead and, you know, as I was researching, I took a look at a couple of other things, a couple of other reports and commissions that came out during the late 60s that in some ways also predicted some of what we're seeing today, and in some instances suggested that if we don't change our course, things will get worse. And we really didn't change our course, and things in many instances have gotten worse. So the words of Dr. King, and then there are others that had also done research and done writings on provided certain reports, especially during the Johnson administration, that suggested that what we are experiencing would happen if we didn't do something about it. And that really kind of was an eye-opener for me. It's not like I didn't know about it, but when you kind of go back and refresh your recollection about some of those things, it's like, wow, people really did have an idea on what was possible for us to change, and for whatever reason, we didn't do that. And here we are today fighting some really big challenges with disparities in our community.
Well, Celia Jackson, thank you so much.
You are welcome. And I just want to say one final thing.
Absolutely.
So I will not conclude with just doom and gloom.
Did you also find some hope in what he said?
Well, I think there's always hope. I mean, and I think that that's the one thing that we have to hold on to. We have to hold on to hope, because you never know when things are going to turn around. But I do have some thoughts and ideas, because there are positive things that are happening in our community, and there are positive things that people are doing to really engage one another. And so I want to be able to lift some of those things up for people to think about, that maybe they're aware of, maybe they're not aware of, but that they can get involved and engage. Because I think we have to continue to prod people in major ways to kind of wake them up. I mean, that was the whole point of a lot of the doom and gloom, was really to wake people up from this slumber that they're in, that, you know, things are only going to get better if we exercise our voice, if we exercise our collective voice, if we really engage collaboratively with one another and just kind of let down all of these barriers that keep us from getting connected. That's really our only hope, and we have to find ways to do that, and preferably not in the midst of a crisis, but really heart-changing, such that it becomes a way of life.
Really important point as well. Celia Jackson, thanks again.
You're welcome.
Celia Jackson is the executive director of the International and Intercultural Center at Milwaukee's El Verno College. She was the speaker this weekend at the 25th annual Martin Luther King Prayer Service, which was sponsored by a variety of organizations, including the Black Catholic Ministry Commission of the Milwaukee Archdiocese and the St. Francis of Assisi Parish.
Jackson spoke about Martin Luther King Jr.'s Remaining Awake Through a Great Revolution sermon, which he delivered on March 31, 1968, at the National Cathedral in Washington. It's a 48-minute-long speech, but here is just a taste of it.
One of the great liabilities of life is that all too many people find themselves living amid a great period of social change. And yet they fail to develop the new attitudes, the new mental responses that the new situation demands. And they end up sleeping through a revolution. Now, there can be no gainsaying of the fact that a great revolution has taken place in the world today. In the sense it is a triple revolution. That is a technological revolution with the impact of automation and cybernation. Then that is a revolution in weaponry with the emergence of atomic and nuclear weapons of warfare. Then that is a human rights revolution. With the freedom explosion that has taken place all over the world. Yes, we do live in a period where changes are taking place, and that is still a voice crying through the vista of time, saying, "Behold, I make all things new. Former things are passed away."
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speaking at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. on March 31, 1968. He was assassinated in Memphis just 5 days later.
Glory. Oh. Glory. Glory. Now the wild.